This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator Podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be turning our attention to the Middle East and the unlikely alliance of Saudi Arabia and Israel as they stare down a common enemy. We'll also be considering whether the old adage, the night is always darkest before the dawn, holds for Theresa May, and wondering why there hasn't been a great musical about British history. First, last week saw a massive anti-corruption push in Saudi Arabia oust a number of princes. The putsch was initiated by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and in this week's magazine cover story, John R. Bradley looks at how the young prince has attempted to align his country with Israeli interests in order to squeeze out a mutual antagonist, Iran. I'm joined now to discuss this issue with Vali Nasir, an Iranian scholar, and Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House. So who is Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Vali?
Well, he's one of the younger sons of the current king, King Salman, who's the son of the founder of Saudi Arabia. And he rose very quickly, first as the deputy crown prince and then as crown prince once his father became king. It appears that he was his father's favorite to assume the mantle of leadership of Saudi Arabia once this king dies, and as he has planned that the leadership would pass to the next generation. He's a very ambitious political leader with a vision to change Saudi Arabia's economy, to change its social political profile, to consolidate power in his own branch of the family, and also to raise the profile of Saudi Arabia as a regional actor, in particular at the expense of Iran's influence in the region.
In his Spectator piece this week, John says that the prince refuses to govern through consensus. Is that a fair assessment of his approach?
The better way to put it is that not he refuses to govern through a consensus, but rather that he sees effective governance, and particularly the kind of changes that he wants to bring to Saudi Arabia, to be possible through a much more centralized control of decision-making. You can change the economy of a country, change the setup of its government, change the social profile of a country without having much more decisive decision-making rather than the back and forth of consensus building. And secondly, he is, of course, trying to consolidate power under himself as a sort of an upstart prince who is assuming a tremendous amount of power out of turn because he's very young for what is often a very gerontocratic political system. And that's not going to happen through consensus. So he clearly is elbowing contenders, doubters, skeptics out of the way very decisively.
Also, the consensus that John is talking about is consensus within the establishment, within the Al Saud dynasty and among influential clerics, well-known business people and so forth. That hasn't exactly been a consensus shared by the wider society. And part of what Mohammed bin Salman seems to be trying to do is to change this model of tribal consensus-based monarchy into a more centralised model of populist authoritarianism, where he sees a big constituency of young Saudis happy to see powerful people brought down for corruption and happy to see the strict social rules altered.
And just staying with you, Jane, 11 senior princes and numerous businessmen were arrested last week. What are the implications of this?
It represents a big change in the way of doing business in Saudi Arabia within the ruling family. Traditionally, senior princes have been above the law. Now, it's also very likely that this crackdown is politically selective. This isn't a country of institutions and the rule of law overnight. But we see that the people arrested do include people who have been alleged to be seriously corrupt for very many years. At the same time, it's convenient that they include people who were either potential royal family rivals once or allies of those sorts of people. Basically, the sons of previous kings and crown princes have been systematically moved out of positions of power since Mohammed bin Salman rose, and the latest scalp to be claimed is Mita bin Abdullah, whose father was the former king. They, between them, had controlled the National Guard, a tribal branch of the military, for 5 decades, and that has been suddenly taken away.
And John Bradley says that Saudi Arabia and Israel are strange bedfellows. How has a mutual distrust of Iran galvanised them, Vali?
Well, as you said, it's a mutual distrust of Iran. In other words, they have a shared interest in rolling back Iran's regional influence. Israel has a very jaded view of Hezbollah's role in Lebanon, of Iran's role regionally, of Iran's nuclear program. And Saudi Arabia largely sees the rise of Iranian influence as diminishing the importance of Saudi Arabia. And therefore, both of them have a common interest in influencing American foreign policy towards Iran and the Middle East. And secondly, in a tangible way, rolling back Iran's influence in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, and closing off Iran's ability to play a part in Yemen or in Bahrain.
There's also a generational issue here where Mohammed bin Salman was born more than a decade after the last big Arab-Israeli war in 1973. He seems to be less interested in the Palestinian issue personally, although he knows it's still an important issue for Saudi society, although it would still be risky for Saudi princes to be seen openly having relations with Israel. It's less of a concern for him than it was for his predecessors.
In terms of the evidence of them working together, Jane, what is there?
There's a tacit alignment of interests rather than direct working together. You've seen close coordination, particularly on lobbying in Washington, where the most prominent actors have been more the United Arab Emirates, who have forged a very, very close bond with Mohammed bin Salman and who have been more forward-leaning in speaking the same language as Israelis when trying to lobby Congress and opinion formers in the US. Behind the scenes, in terms of whether there is a lot of information sharing or intelligence sharing, that's all very much more opaque.
Vali, how does this play with recent revolutions in Arab countries where the West has backed supposedly liberal autocrats?
Well, when the Arab Spring started, Saudi Arabia rolled out actually a very expensive entitlement program in order to pacify the population. But I think the underlying message that young Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been giving to the West is that an era of low oil prices and given the restlessness of Arab society, that Saudi Arabia has no choice but to diversify its economy, to restructure it, and to seek a very different future than the one that was laid out at the era of high oil prices. And so his drive to consolidate power, change the country's economy, change the relationship with the conservative establishment, undertaking such measures as allowing women to drive, the very broad vision that he laid out for creating an entire new area in Saudi Arabia, the sort of city territory of Neom, which would be much more like Dubai than Saudi Arabia has been. All of this has to do in a way to address the long run demographic economic problem of the Arab world. Although in the short run, Saudi Arabia has to contend with disgruntled youth, many of whom have been influenced by the Muslim Brotherhood, and were very sympathetic to what was happening in Egypt and Tunisia during the heyday of the unrest.
The article is absolutely right that Western governments are pretty favourable, especially, of course, Donald Trump, towards a leader who is autocratic but espousing a partial kind of liberalism, a social and economic, if not political or institutional, type of liberalism. But something interesting, Saudi Arabia basically convinced Western governments after 9/11 that democracy in Saudi Arabia would not be good for the West, that if there were elections, that would empower extremists, Islamists, in the worst case scenario, some kind of ISIS-lite. If Mohammed bin Salman is now saying, actually, our society is ready for liberalisation, actually, we are much more educated and liberal than the rest of the world always thought, that argument starts to break down.
That was Vali Nasir and Jane Kinnamont.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, the host of The Spectator's Books podcast. This week's episode sees me talk to Hilary Sperling, the prize-winning author of biographies of Matisse and Pearl Buck, among others, who's turned her attention at last to a magisterial biography of Anthony Pohl, author of A Dance to the Music of Time.
Next, after Tory conference, it seemed briefly as though things could get no worse for Theresa May. A month later, and Westminster is sinking in a sleaze scandal, whilst the Prime Minister's cabinet is in disarray. Can things, in the words of New Labour, only get better? James Forsyth looks at the future of the Tory party in his column this week, and he joins me now along with The Spectator's editor, Fraser Nelson. So James, could it actually get any worse for Theresa May?
Yes, I think it can get worse. You've got the budget, which is now 2 weeks away. And there is, I think, still a kind of standoff between Number 10 and the Treasury about what to do about housing policy. If the budget went wrong, things would get worse. If in December the European Union said, no, we haven't made sufficient progress to move on to trade and transition, things could get worse. And then there is obviously the fate of Damian Green. If Sue Gray's Cabinet Office inquiry into his personal conduct finds against him, or is negative enough that Theresa May comes under huge pressure to let him go, then things could get worse again. I think this is the really thing that is alarming Tory ministers and MPs, that they haven't hit rock bottom yet.
Fraser, not all of this mess is Theresa May's fault, is it?
I don't know. I mean, none of it directly is her fault. But I can't help thinking if this were Tony Blair's government and the control freak Alistair Campbell were in Number 10, a lot of these problems would not be allowed to get off the ground. For example, how can you have a situation where there was so much confusion about what Priti Patel had said and what she hadn't said? The fact that you allow that confusion to exist and to build, I think, is evidence of a lack of prime ministerial grip. The same with Boris Johnson mangling his words. If you dealt with that problem very quickly, it would not have been allowed to get as big as it did. So I think what we can see here are, sure, individual examples of government members dropping the ball, but collectively, you can see a government falling apart at the seams because nothing's holding it together. And this comes back to a difficult question that Tory MPs have been asking themselves. Can we keep Theresa May in place, aiming that she more or less keeps things as they are, aiming for stagnation until March 2019, the end of the Brexit talks? As it turns out, you can't do that. You need to be pretty active to stay still. And right now, because she isn't active, because there's a great vacuum where the Prime Minister ought to be, things are falling apart.
And James, you've talked about the threat of losing Damian Green to Theresa May's authority. After her conference speech went so badly wrong, I spoke to a number of Conservatives who were suggesting that part of the blame must lie with the people around May, who are still, in their view, inadequate. Is that still the case, aside from Green?
I think this Number 10 is swamped. I think the problem is this. First of all, it is understaffed. There are simply not enough people there. Secondly, it is trying to deal with Brexit, which is the biggest peacetime challenge that any UK government has had since the war. And then I think you add on top of this, kind of this whole sexual scandal, and it's very difficult to see how you have just enough bandwidth to deal with all that stuff. And then you've obviously still got universal credit, the budget, all this other stuff. And I think what is so difficult, and this is one of the odd things, which is, on paper, it's hard to think of a Prime Minister better place to deal with this sexual scandal than Theresa May, in that she is authentically not part of this Westminster culture. No one thinks that Theresa May really knew what was going on. I mean, she is someone who is, you know, the reason she doesn't have that many friends is that she's never kind of put herself into that Westminster social scene in any way, shape or form.
And she played that up as a strength.
Yeah, as a strength. And that, I think, one of the reasons why she was initially so popular with the public. But despite those strengths, she can't get a grip on this scandal. They still, Number 10 seems to be kind of oscillating wildly in how they want to handle this, whether they want to look like the people who are kind of, to borrow Ruth Davidson's phrase, kind of cleaning up the Augean stables, kind of sacking everyone, all this stuff, or whether they just want to get through this losing as few people as possible. I'm still not clear which of those Number 10 are trying to do.
Fraser, can Theresa May recover from this in the long term?
No, absolutely not. The damage is permanent. I mean, she keeps sustaining damage, so she looks more and more tattered. She wasn't able to recover after blowing the general election, so ever since then, her time has been marked. But now, on top of the charge of blowing an election, you get your inability to hold the government together. You now get the allegations of sleaze, which are descending on this government as they descended on John Major's, and for the same reason, that if you run out of things to do or say, then you invite unhappy accidents. So I think each of these things will further diminish the Conservatives' brand and the reputation. Now, I spoke to a cabinet member the other day who was saying, look, it's still okay. We're only 1 point behind Jeremy Corbyn in the opinion polls. That is certainly true. Theresa May's personal rating is not as bad as it was with John Major and Gordon Brown at their nadir. But I don't think you can shrug off the impression of incompetence. And that is a dreadful thing for Conservatives. They're by and large seen as being cruel but competent. If you take away the competence, there's not much left.
So what about Labour, James?
I think this is the fascinating question is, Labour are basically benefiting by keeping their heads down here. Jeremy Corbyn hasn't got a position on Brexit, even less of a position on Brexit than Theresa May has. But this is basically working for them because they are trying to work on the old maxim that governments lose elections rather than oppositions winning them. I mean, the interesting question is everyone on the centre-left going to be prepared to accept a Corbyn premiership? Or does someone think, actually, the only way to keep him out of number 10 is to throw money at founding some new party that basically acts as a spoiler, that gets between 4 and 6% of the vote, but brings the overwhelming amount of that off Labour, basically offers to be a home to kind of young professionals who voted Remain, who can't stand the Tories because of that, and that that crucially would, in under the British electoral system, in enough constituencies, would stop Labour from winning, to stop Corbyn from, at the very least, governing outright.
Fraser, how close is Labour to government in terms of, well, it's very difficult for us to make any predictions at the moment, but as we've been discussing, the May government isn't going anywhere. It looks as though it's just holding on for dear life.
You're right, and often it looks as if it might fall apart at any moment. You think that we, you know, so many people will resign, you'll run out of people to replace them with. Or Anna Soubry might find, you know, a dozen or so like-minded Tory MPs willing to vote for an early general election. That's quite a big threshold to cross. For this government to fall, you need a significant number of Tories to really think that a general election is worthwhile, and I don't think that's going to happen. There's still the DUP don't want a general election to happen.
The SNP don't want a general election to happen.
So there are lots of reasons why this kind of horror show can go on for quite some time. But then again, if we've learned anything in the last year in politics, it's not to rule out eventualities. I mean, 6 months ago, we hadn't even had the May general election, where the Tories looked as if they're going to take all the ground that lay before them. So at a time where the wheel of political fortune is spinning so completely and so quickly, it would be a brave man who would rule out Jeremy Corbyn coming. In the leading article of the magazine, we conclude by saying that people laughed at Jeremy Corbyn when he said that he might not have won the election this time, but he'd be back in a year. Right now, it would be a brave man who would say that that definitely wouldn't happen.
And James, what impact is all this instability having on Britain's position in the Brexit negotiations?
I think that the Brexit bill just got bigger. I mean, the European Union know that Theresa May desperately needs to get trade and transition in December. And I think, you know, this is a negotiation. They see that the opposite number is weak and they will try and push her. Now, what she did at the last European Council was rather counterintuitive. She basically turned up and said, I am so weak. If you don't help me out, I will fall and you will end up having to negotiate with Boris Johnson. Do you really want that? I mean, she didn't say Boris Johnson directly. It was
That's the calculation.
Heavily implied.
I wonder, so is that why she can't sack Boris? Because he's then not a deterrent in the foreign office?
I wonder whether she can try that trick in December again and whether it will work in terms of getting to sufficient progress to move on to trade and transition. I think there is also this, which is what worries me, is the EU offered the UK a kind of olive branch in these talks, basically saying you can kind of feed into our discussions on the future relationship. I don't see how we can feed in right now, because we don't know what we want that future relationship to be. And the Cabinet have, amazingly, the Cabinet have never discussed it. They've never sat down and said, right, are we prepared to lose some market access in exchange for the ability to diverge from EU regulations? But that most basic conversation, which should have been the conversation that they were having on June the 30th last year, they still haven't had yet.
Well, that's not going to change just because Theresa May has sacked Priti Patel.
No, it's not going to change, but the Cabinet are getting restive about this. I mean, when James disclosed that in his column, that the Cabinet has never discussed what Brexit they want, Cabinet members did afterwards say, look, this is now getting out, it's really embarrassed that we haven't had discussion, so why don't we talk about it? And of course, they would say that what we want is, we want as much free trade as the EU can bear to give us. But then there are arguments going on about whether we're prepared to have regulatory equivalence with the EU, in other words, mirror what they do, which is effectively staying in the system, or whether we want to say that we're going to do things to their standard but in our own different way. That's an argument going on right now in Cabinet. But right now, I suppose the other thing is so many Tories just don't know they're going to be in their jobs in 2 or 3 weeks' time. There is a sort of crisis, an air of crisis, which started off with the sex allegations, which now has ended up to far more substantially governmental faults. And it seems that every week Theresa May tries to carry on, she's going to attract yet another crisis. And all of this has given this incredible debilitating effect to a government which is no longer hardly worthy of the name.
James, is number 10 actually having any ambition on domestic policy now? I mean, is there a grid at the moment, for instance, that involves anything to do with policy making, domestic agenda?
So number 10 They have their British dream. They have Theresa May's burning injustice that she set out on the steps of Downing Street. And they have some, what I think you could call some kind of micro policies that go with that. But an overriding sense of domestic purpose, there isn't there yet. That is why I think it is so vital that the budget does something really big on housing. Because that would at least give them something. And it would give them something that they could turn around to younger voters and say, look, we're doing this. You know, we are going to ensure that the dream of a property-owning democracy doesn't die. They just need to have something. And at the moment, I think the problem is they are being buffeted by events. But if a ship in a storm doesn't know what port it is trying to get to, it is going to get buffeted by the storm and just blown around all over the place. If you know where you're trying to get to, you've at least got a chance of making it to your destination.
This is the fundamental problem, because at the root of all of these things is a lack of leadership. And it's difficult to work out how anybody can apply that. You're right, James, the budget might be able to fill that hole, but given Philip Hammond's appalling track record on political judgments, I would be surprised if he manages that. And right now, I'm beginning to wonder if Theresa May will ever be able to even fake leadership. I just can see this vacuum continuing, and cabinet members go off and doing their own competing things, and this sense of disarray just becoming bigger and bigger.
But I just had a very telling conversation with Tory MPs, so we can't go on like this. And then they went through the cabinet, and you suddenly realise, well, you could end up going on like this. Because
there's nobody else.
But yeah, exactly. You basically can almost disqualify everyone in the senior jobs in the cabinet.
That was Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. For daily updates on continuing cabinet shambles, tune into our politics podcast, Coffeehouse Shots. And if you want to hear Fraser and James in person, they'll be discussing the future of the Tory party on November the 27th at the Emmanuel Centre. Just go to spectator.co.uk/events for tickets.
Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffeehouse. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.
And finally, with Hamilton winning awards and breaking box office records across the Atlantic, why hasn't there been a great musical about British history? Ian Hollingshead investigates in the magazine this week, and he joins me now along with Eleanor Shaw, an actress in Ian's musical The End of History, which opens next week at the Tristan Bates Theatre. So Ian, how has Hamilton changed the musical theatre landscape?
I think it's changed it in a number of ways. I mean, one is that it mixes so many different genres together of music. So you've got show tunes, then you've also got rap and hip-hop and bringing it all together. But I think it's also interesting in terms of taking what seems to be quite difficult and inaccessible subject matter. You know, the story of the founding fathers of America is not an instant musical hit, or it doesn't seem like one anyway. And I think it shows that you can talk about quite difficult and quite serious issues in musicals and make them a success as well.
So why is it that we don't have a British Hamilton?
That's a good question. I mean, the Americans have an amazing founding myth, and it's slightly airbrushed, it's a little bit too convenient, but their founding myth is all about throwing off the evil British oppressor, George III, and American freedom and liberty and the birthing stories of a great nation. Britain doesn't really have a founding myth in the same way. We've got a convoluted history of 1066 and the Acts of Union and Brexit. There's not even a university to find British history compared to English history, so it's very hard to say that this is our story and this is where it begins.
But you have tried to address this yourself.
Well, we've done our best. I mean, it's not, the focus isn't overly British. We're looking at 20th century international history.
In a musical, yes.
Our musical is called The End of History. And it's about, obviously, it's a nod to Fukuyama in his book about 1989 and the end of the ideological battle between West and East, which, again, doesn't sound very promising for a hit musical. But it's about international relations in the 20th century, which are fascinating. And I think they work really well in a musical because we're bringing it into a school context. So we've got two parallel narratives side by side about teenagers trying to find their way not only through puberty but also through 20th century history and finding there's actually a lot more in common between the two than they might actually realise.
And Eleanor, you play a starring role in this musical. Tell us a little bit about your character.
I play a teenager in the history class called Beth, whose narrative also represents the kind of story of Britain during the 20th century. So she starts off as being sort of the class queen. She's, you know, top of the pack, and she's best friends, in inverted commas, with Fran, who sort of represents France, but she kind of tumbles a little bit throughout the first act and strikes up a special relationship with Andy, who represents America.
Does this feel like a dramatic change for you in terms of your repertoire?
No, not really. So I'm pretty fresh out of college. When I read the script and I read the part of Beth, I was like, this was me. She's a real goody-goody. She really sucks up to the teacher. She's already got the textbook. She's already got all the notes ready. So I was like, there's very little I have to do dramatically.
I think one thing we found, just going back to your previous question about the role of Beth and Britain in the 20th century, if you look at a country like Germany or Russia, who's also represented in the musical and within the class body, is they have a really interesting narrative arc, and a narrative arc which works in some ways much more conveniently into drama. You look at Germany punished, rehabilitated, punished again, emerging triumphant in Europe. Likewise, America, isolationist, and then re-emerging as a superpower. Whereas Britain's story, Beth's story in the 20th century, is more one of decline, really, isn't it? Which is harder to celebrate.
But we are obsessed as a nation with historical dramas and historical fiction. Eleanor, why is it that we haven't had much in terms of our own history in musicals?
Nothing really jumps out. And I know that when Lin-Manuel Miranda picked up this biography of Hamilton by Ron Chernow, and he said that reading the story, it really struck him as a hip-hop story, basically rags to riches. And I don't think we have that kind of myth in our pop culture alongside in our historical identity.
I think another problem, along with the founding myth and the lack of it, is that a lot of British history is controversial, without being, you know, an apologist for people who want to talk down British history. But if you look at, you know, a story of decline, a story of imperialism, I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know, Mau Mau the musical. There's a lot in British history which is awkward and hard to deal with. But I think there's a disconnect when you look about how popular history is in every other cultural medium, in novels, in Downton Abbey, and yet musical theatre seems to shy away from it. And I think that is a shame. I think there are great stories which could be unearthed, it's just people haven't done so yet.
Wolf Hall, for instance, would that make a good musical?
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, it makes fantastic television as well as a great novel.
It's not very cheery, though, is it? I mean, I have to say, most of the musicals I've seen, like Cats, Starlight Express, they have a sort of upbeat ending. I'm not sure whether the beheading song would be
yes. The same. And a lot of musicals are upbeat, and I think, you know, there is a snobbery about musical theatre, partly because some of it is upbeat. But for me, I mean, some of my favourite musicals are things like either comic ones like Avenue Q or ones which are nearer to opera. I mean, look at Les Miserables. That doesn't have a very upbeat ending either.
I mean, Miss Saigon is like the most depressing ending you can imagine. And that is historical in a sense. It was, you know, strangely written by two French people.
And that's an updated opera too, isn't it?
Precisely. Yeah.
And do you think that musicals have got a bad reputation?
I do. So when I have to come out to people as a musical theatre actress, as a performer, so I usually introduce myself as, oh, you know, I'm an actor. And they go, you know, well, what do you do? I go, oh, musical theatre. And you can see people's perception change, and they're just like, okay, so, you know, you're all tits and teeth, sequins and things like that. And there's definitely a place for the likes of 42nd Street, fun, frothy, you know, partly frivolous musicals, because that's an escapism. But also my favourite musicals, and I think this is something that America and American writers understand more, is that musicals don't have to be completely frivolous and uniquely frivolous. I think that British people, despite the prominence of the West End and the shows that have been running for years and years, think that British people still think that musicals are purely entertaining and escapism, whereas they can be phenomenally educational and powerful.
I think they can be both. I think that's what's so powerful. Yeah. They can be escapism and they can also be moving and dramatic. There's that lovely quote by Voltaire, anything too stupid to be said is sung. And I think that's sometimes the case in musical. You have the kind of, now I'm going to sing about my feelings and my emotions song.
Which is dealt with really amazingly in Leonard Bernstein's musical version of Candide, which is a Voltaire short story. So I just think that comes round full circle really gloriously.
In our musical, At the End of History, it allows us to have a kind of a disconnect, well, not a disconnect, but an escapism in the classroom. So you have the teacher teaching a classroom scene, then you morph into the history. And I think you could only do that through the medium of music, to suddenly have the people, you know, representing Woodrow Wilson as opposed to representing a teenager. And I think that works in musical and through dance as well.
What was the most difficult song to write for this musical?
I think the most difficult song to write was probably the big ensemble numbers, but they were also the most satisfying. So we have a big one at the end of Act One called Peace for Our Time, obviously a reference to Chamberlain's piece of paper and that famous quote as he came out from Munich. But we're trying to bring in an awful lot of different opinions, appeasement, Russia's concern about German aggression and expansionism, Italy and Japan allying themselves with Germany. And I think it works. I hope it works. But when it all comes together, that's very satisfying. But I really enjoyed those big historical numbers, the Versailles, the Peace for Our Time. There's another one called Tear Down This Wall, which is a Reagan quote to Gorbachev, and that's done in kind of 80s rock. So all the music mirrors the music of the time. So Versailles is 1920s French jazz, 1930s big band, 1980s rock, etc. We've got a rock and roll number about China and Russia spreading communism in the 60s. So it's been really fun trying to work that out.
Well, Eleanor, we would love it if you gave us just a little taste of one of those songs that you have to sing in this musical.
This is the chorus from Peace for Our Time, where I am representing Neville Chamberlain.
We've no backing from our empire. The Great War has left its scars. We've seen the bombs of Guernica. We'll leave Deutschland her backyard. Here's my piece of paper. It's peace for our time. Here's my piece of paper. It's peace for our time.
That was Ian Hollingshead and Eleanor Shaw. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast, where this week Damien Thompson and Christina Adoni speak to Quentin Letts. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Tina Brown, Melissa Kite and Jenny Code. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator moleskin notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening and do join us again next week.